extremely odd behavior, so either he's an irredeemable gossip or someone put him up to it. I think for a bit. I can take a look in his file and ask Paul about him. If he's known to be the town crier, then maybe it's just incredibly bad luck that he's got hold of this. Tom turns his attention to the oven. The last few moments have stripped away some of my distrust, or perhaps my growing exhaustion has done that. Suspicion is so damn tiring. Things would be so much simpler if Tom was on my side. I'm almost sure he is. I'm almost sure Tom is Tom, and all the rest of it is just noise. It's certainly what I want to believe. That night, with Severine, I start hesitantly. Tom looks up in the act of removing the pizzas, with a lightness in his eyes that warms me. He recognizes the olive branch. At first I thought, well, I thought she went to the bus depot the next morning, so I thought it was nothing to do with all of us. Then afterward, when Mordan said it wasn't her, then I started thinking. And the thing is, I don't know what time Seb came to bed. I was pretty upset and pretty drunk, to be honest. I think I just passed out, so I really don't know. But then Seb was really insistent that he was there all night. Lara and Tom are both watching me, letting the words run out of me. And he and Carol are acting so strangely, so complicit. I actually wondered if they were shagging. But I think it's all to do with this, with Severine. I take a deep breath, looking at Tom. If I say this, it becomes possible. If I say this, I can never take it back. So I guess I've been wondering if Seb killed her by accident, and if Carol helped cover it up. I hear Lara mutter, "Jesus," and in my peripheral vision she reaches for the wine bottle. But I'm focused on Tom. He nods calmly, thoughtfully. He's not surprised, and by now, I'm not surprised about that. "Caro," he says. He's speaking dispassionately, simultaneously carving up the slightly burned pizzas with a circular cutter, as if we're discussing interest rates or car insurance. "Not me, for the cover-up?" In the moment, I am unable to think of anything to say but the truth. "It could have been you. But like you said, I don't think you would have had enough time to manage it without Lara suspecting something. And..." "What?" His cutting of the pizza continues, unhurried, and his question is casual, but his eyes on me are anything but. I shrug again. "I guess I think that if it had been you, it would have been a better cover-up."
"Thank you, I think," he says dryly,
but the tension has left him, and a smile lurks round his mouth. "Was it such a bad cover-up?" asks Lara. "It took 10 years for the body to be found." Severine has perched her bottom on the granite surface beside the sink. She crosses her legs and supports her upper body with her arms braced behind her. She doesn't shock me with her sudden appearances anymore. I wonder if I would miss her if she were to go wherever ghosts go when they're done haunting.
"If it was a random stranger, then it's a poorly executed cover-up that just got lucky," says Tom. "You'd have to expect the well to be searched sometime early on, and a stranger wouldn't know it was due to be filled in soon." "But we knew that. Even so, even with it being filled in, you'd have to think it would be searched sooner rather than later."
"What would you have done?" I ask curiously.
"Taken your car keys and dumped her somewhere far away," he says promptly, so promptly that I know he's thought about this before.
"Mordan asked about cars." I trail off. There's a tendril of something in my brain that I can't quite catch. Severine has a cigarette in her hand now. She blows out smoke in a slow, languid breath, her eyes fixed on me, as dark and unreflective as always.
"We're really considering this, then," says Lara to no one in particular. "That it could have been Seb, one of us."
There's nothing to say to that. She reaches for a slice of pizza, then pauses with it part way to her mouth to remark,
If Caro was involved, it would have to be for Seb. I can't imagine her doing that for anyone else.
She thinks for a moment more, then gestures with the pizza.
Caro and Seb. God, I hope he's not that stupid.
He's pretty stupid at times, but even so.
Tom grimaces, but then shakes his head. They're both sneaking wary glances at me. The instinct not to talk about Seb in front of me has become so ingrained over the years that they're struggling to shake it.
Tom shakes his head again. I'm sure he's not. He must know it would mean too much to her.
Has everybody always known that? I ask hesitantly. I don't think I did back then. Did I miss it? I knew she didn't like me going out with Seb, but I thought she just didn't like me.
She didn't like you, Tom says, not without humor, at the same time as Laura says. She still doesn't like you.
A smile curls my lips despite myself.
No, really, guys, don't beat around the bush on my account.
Tom grins and Laura giggles. I knew she didn't like me, but I didn't think it was me so much as what I represent, or what I don't represent. I didn't go to the right school, I didn't spend my summers in Pony Club, and winters in Verbier. I don't have the right accent.
Val d'Isère, says Tom.
I roll my eyes. How is it that we're now back at this easy ebb and flow? Surely there has to be a reckoning at some point.
But I take your point, she's a snob. Of course she wouldn't like you. But especially not since you were dating Seb.
You're right, though, she's more obvious now, Lara observes. I munch on the pizza and let this marinate. The trick is to take in the new without polluting the old, and I don't think I've got the hang of it. It's too easy to project what I know now on what I remember from then. I remember Seb. I remember the faint disbelief I carried around inside me that Seb, silver-spooned, silver-tongued, golden-hued Seb, that he was with me. Part of me expected all girls to want him. And Seb, well, Seb expected it too. He took it as his right, and any suggestion that he encouraged it was instantly labeled jealousy. I decided early on that I would not allow him to brand me with that. But that required a lot of hard work and, in retrospect, willful ignorance. Perhaps it's no wonder I dismissed Caro's long-held unrequited love too lightly. I finish my slice before I break the companionable silence. Anyway, we've strayed from the point. Tom, what do you think happened? You've always known more than us.
He doesn't dispute it.
I was actually trying not to drag you guys into it. We're pretty firmly mired in it all now.
Speak for yourself, yawns Lara. I'm sure I'm off the hook.
I give her arm a gentle poke. So much for solidarity. Well, I'm pretty firmly mired in it all, at least.
He doesn't dispute that, either.
You saw something, Lara prompts.
He nods.
I did. A loud buzz interrupts him. He cocks his head and turns toward his door. Probably a mistake. A drunk or something.
The buzzer sounds again, in three short blasts, then a long hold.
A highly obnoxious drunk.
He crosses the kitchen quickly and exits to the hall. We hear him speaking tersely to the intercom by his front door.
Hello?
It's me,
comes an unmistakable voice, unexpectedly loud through the speaker. Lara's guilt-filled eyes fly to mine, which no doubt display the same.
Speak of the devil.
Let me up. I'm the glad bearer of tidings. The bearer of glad tidings, or something.
Come on up, then. Tom sounds resigned. He reappears in the doorway of the kitchen.
Seb, he says, unnecessarily.
Lara makes a face.
Definitely an obnoxious drunk, then, though who am I to talk after all this wine?
She slides down the stool and turns for her bag and coat. I'm going to have to leave you to it.
I'll come with you, but I'm still perched on the stool,
anchored by the same one ankle.
Stay, Tom says quickly. I'll get rid of him.
I raise an eyebrow.
Charming. Whatever happened to blood being thicker than water?
Doesn't apply when the blood is thinned by alcohol. He'll probably have to slope home to Alina soon anyway. Lara is not too sleepy to have missed this exchange. I see her eyes dart back and forth between us as she pulls her coat on, but her face is carefully expressionless.
Call me tomorrow, she says to me neutrally. You can fill me in on the outcome of the rest of this Nancy Drew session.
And so, I stare.
Chapter 16. Seb is drunk. Not just a little squiffy, or even moderately tipsy, but unequivocally drunk. The sort of drunk that can only be achieved by dedicated effort, a long, brutally determined session, or by a staggering lack of tolerance. But I'm beginning to suspect that Seb's tolerance has been well bolstered over the last decade.
Jesus, says Tom, as Seb stumbles in through the kitchen door that Lara has just slipped out of, catching hold of the frame to steady himself. He's in a dark suit, the tail of his tie dangling from his trouser pocket, and there are stains on his white shirt. But it's his face that really arrests attention. His eyes are glazed and patterned with red veins like cracks. He's flushed, heavy-jowled and loose-lipped. The tan that sits on his skin is too insubstantial to hide the damage of his night's work.
Look at the state of you. Where have you been?
The King's Head by the office. Leaving drinks. They're firing half the bloody floor. There's been leaving drinks for weeks. Then a bloody good wine bar in Knightsbridge. Then, God, I don't know.
He peers across the room, as if struggling to see through darkness despite the kitchen being well lit, swaying slightly despite the support of the doorframe.
Kate, too. You know, I just saw Lara on the way up the stairs.
His speech is slurred. He has particular trouble with Lara. It could be Lala or Lula.
Hi, Seb. I make no move to climb off the stool. He is not something I want to kiss hello.
Come and have a glass of water, Tom says, running the tap in the sink. He eyes the difficult stools.
On second thought, maybe we should move to the sofa.
Not water,
says Seb, shaking his head, but he lets Tom shepherd him through the open-plan room in the direction of the living room area. I take the water glass off Tom in return for a muttered thanks, and then follow the pair of them.
Need something stronger. Wet the baby's head. Alina's pregnant. Gonna be a dad.
Fuck.
He sounds astonished, as if he can't quite understand how he got to this point.
Congratulations. Didn't know. Whoa there. You had it in you.
I can hear the exasperation under Tom's words as he tries to stop Seb ricocheting off the walls, knocking awry the photographic prints Tom has hung there. I pause by the dining table that separates the kitchen space from the living room area and compose myself. Seb has collapsed onto one sofa, legs sprawled out, shoulders hunched over, well below the line of the sofa back. Severine sits in the opposite corner of the same sofa, her feet curled up under her, eyeing Seb with unmistakable distaste. Tom switches on a couple of table lamps, then sits in the armchair.
Congratulations, Seb, I say, holding out the water.
He doesn't take it. I'm sure he can barely see it, so I put it on the coffee table. I can't bring myself to sit on Severine, or near Seb for that matter, so I settle on the footstool.
How is Alina feeling?
Oh, fine, fine. She's always fine.
I think of Alina with the crumpled paper towel in the bathroom of the restaurant. No, Alina is not always fine.
How far along is she? Asks Tom. 10 weeks. Not supposed to say yet, but...
He shrugs. I can barely discern the movement. His head is sunk so deeply into his chest.
Fuck. Baby.
A phone starts to ring from the depths of his suit jacket. He clumsily pulls it out, peers at the screen, then leans forward to deposit it on the table without answering. He passes a hand over his face, then collapses back into the sofa again. Just when I think he's passed out, he turns to me with an unexpectedly shrewd look.
What are you doing here anyway? Have I interrupted something?
He starts to laugh, as if the idea is hilarious.
Sloppy seconds, huh, Tom?
In that instant, I detest him with a force that's blinding. I actually want to physically hurt him. It scares me.
You just saw Lara, Seb,
Tom reminds him evenly, but his jaw is clenched. He's not looking at me. It feels deliberate.
You think I'm screwing them both?
Screwing. To screw, a verb. I screw, we screw, they screwed. Screw you. It can never sound anything but cheap, sordid. Is that how he thinks of the corridor kiss?
Ah, Seb snorts. Don't tell me it never crossed your mind. It certainly crossed mine once or twice.
In another world, in other circumstances, this would be harmless fun. The kind of flirting men do with attractive female friends that elicits a naughty giggle and a warm glow. But we're not in that world. There's a hard edge to Seb's words, a nastiness. Was he always like this when he'd had a few? I recall Lara's words.
Definitely an obnoxious drunk, then.
I can't specifically recall it, but it doesn't quite surprise me either. I stand up abruptly. I think I'll head home after all. The company's better there. Severine eyes me from the sofa, as close to a smirk on her face as I have ever seen. At least I've conjured up a figment of imagination that appreciates my sly digs.
No, don't,
says Seb. He struggles himself a little more upright and lunges out with an arm to try and stop me.
I'm sorry. Don't take it like that. I was just having fun. Don't have to take everything so seriously. Sorry, sorry.
His mumbles trail off, but he continues to look at me beseechingly, somehow both aggrieved and hangdog, a little boy mostly pretending to be ashamed of himself. This I remember. Seb is a master at apologies that somehow make you feel like the fault is more than likely your own. The phone starts to ring again. He drops my arm.
Alina?
Asks Tom. But from my vantage point of standing, I can see on the screen that it's not Alina calling. It's Caro, I inform them. But I think Seb knows that. He's made no move to answer. I can see he's missed 8 calls. I wonder how many are from Caro. The phone subsides into sulky silence.
Would never have met you if it wasn't for Tom,
Seb rambles, as if there's been no interruption. He seems to have found a philosophical bent.
That's why we went to that party, you know, when we crashed Lineker Ball. Tom wanted to see some girl.
He trails off, smirking at Tom. I catch a glimpse of Tom's face, set with tension. I don't understand the undercurrent. Who? I prompt, when Seb doesn't go on. I've never heard this story before.
Yes. Who was that girl? I don't think you ever told me, says Seb, with faux innocence.
But in his inebriated state, subtlety is beyond him. Seb, I deduce, knows exactly who it was.
Who knows? It was a long time ago,
Tom says tightly. But he's interrupted by Seb's mobile ringing once more. It's Caro again, I say neutrally.
I know,
he mutters. His head is sunk on his chest again.
Fuck.
This time it's more of a moan.
Why is Caro calling you so much?
Tom asks, as if it's only of the mildest interest to him.
I'm not sleeping with her, if that's what you think.
He's both belligerent and defensive. His fabled charm has most definitely fled him this evening.
I never said, yeah, well, you implied it. Of course I'm not sleeping with her. I'm not completely stupid. Never have in all these years.
His head lolls again.
Barely even kissed her,
he mutters. He rubs a hand down his face, then lunges drunkenly for my arm again, and catches it, pulling me down awkwardly so I'm half hunched over.
I fucked up, Kate,
he mumbles urgently, looking straight in my eyes.
Should never have given up on us. Everything was okay, wasn't it? We were good, weren't we? But then I fucked up. And now... Oh, fuck.
I start to feel a sense of foreboding building in my stomach. Seb releases my arm abruptly, and I lose my balance, grabbing at the coffee table to steady myself. When I look back at Seb, he has his arm raised, shielding his eyes with his forearm. I glance at Tom questioningly. He shakes his head, nonplussed. Seb, what's wrong? I ask hesitantly. What is it?
Leaving drinks.
His lips fumble around the words, thick and rubbery.
My leaving drinks.
But you just came across from New York. Surely they wouldn't fire you when...
Not fired. Resigned. Not fired. My boss was kind enough to give me the option.
His arm is still over his eyes.
What did you do?
Tom asks, brutally direct.
What I always do. I fucked up.
He lifts his arm away. It's hard to tell in the dim lighting, but I think his eyes are wet.
Not like you, Tom? You always hit the mark. Tom is doing so well at school. Tom's won a scholarship, didn't you hear? Tom's really racing up the career ladder. You know he's head of FX trading now. Why can't you be more like your cousin?
My breath catches in shock. I can't imagine Seb would ever betray such bitterness were it not for the amount he's drunk, and I can't imagine he would want me to see this. I feel instantly grimy, like I'm peeping in on a private scene. Tom's face is impassive. I wonder if he's heard this before or simply guessed at the simmering resentment. What did you do? Tom repeats, remarkably undeterred. Seb rubs a hand over his face, and all the fight seems to leave him.
I was drunk, he says hoarsely. At work. All this stuff with that fucking French girl and Alina and the baby, and then Caro in my ear. It just got too much.
He presses the heels of his hands into his eye sockets and leaves them there.
Fuck!
He says, with explosive savagery. When Tom shakes his head, I can see exasperation warring with pity upon his face.
Oh, Seb, he says softly.
That fucking French girl. A literal statement in this case, since he was the one fucking her. But one look at Seb's distress robs me of my ironic amusement. There's nothing to laugh at here. I'm sorry, I say inadequately. I look at Tom. You should call Alina and let her know he's here. She's probably worried sick. He nods and picks up Seb's mobile to scroll through the directory for Alina's number, stepping toward the corridor to make the call. I wonder if he's also checking how many times Caro has rung. I would be. Seb is falling asleep, I think. I suppose he will have to stay here, and therefore Tom and I are unlikely to have our tete-a-tete tonight after all. I should go. In fact, I'm eager to go. Watching someone unravel is far from comfortable, and Severine has already ditched the scene. I make a move toward the corridor, but suddenly Seb lunges for my arm once more. Not asleep after all. He pulls me into that awkward crouch again, but this time I'm forewarned.
I brace myself on the arm of the sofa.
It wasn't me,
he says urgently, pleadingly, his bloodshot eyes seeking mine out directly.
You have to know that. It wasn't me. I would have remembered if it was me, wouldn't I? It couldn't have been me. I came to bed. It couldn't have been me.
I'm helpless for words. Hypothetically discussing Seb as a suspect for murder in Tom's kitchen over pizza is a far cry from facing down the mess that is the man himself. Tom's footsteps sound behind me, and I turn, relieved at the interruption. But I see Tom halt abruptly at the sight of us, his face frozen. I'm suddenly horribly aware of how close Seb's face is to mine. I start to disengage my arm just as Seb blurts,
I think I'm going to vomit.
He releases me and lurches upward as I scatter backward. Tom starts back into action, practically hauling him by the collar toward the bathroom. Moments later, I hear the unmistakable sound of Seb's stomach evacuating itself. I climb back onto my feet and go in search of my coat and my handbag, both of which are still in the kitchen. The dirty pizza plates are still on the counter. If I were a truly wonderful guest, I would wash them up. But given it's now past midnight, I am definitely nowhere near wonderful. The most I have the energy for is to stack them in the sink, since on inspection the dishwasher is full. My mind is flitting from Seb's desperate, pleading eyes to Tom's shuttered face and back again. It's hardly the most important question, but I keep wondering who the girl was, the girl that Tom dragged Seb to the party for. Once upon a time I would have landed upon one name only, but I'm starting to think there's a second option. I pick up my coat and exit the kitchen to find Tom hovering in the corridor, lit only by the yellow slash of light coming from the bottom of the bathroom door, and the dim light spilling in from the kitchen and living room. You got hold of Alina? I ask, to cover my awkwardness. Tom and I, alone again in the same corridor. How could it not be awkward?
Yeah, he's going to stay here for tonight.
He's leaning his back against the wall. I can barely see the white of his teeth as he yawns. She knew about him losing his job. She brought it up. I was wondering whether Seb would have told her or not. How did she sound? I put my bag down and begin to pull on my coat.
I don't know. Frustrated mostly, I think.
Another deep retch comes from the bathroom. My eyes are adjusting to the light. I can just make out a grimace of part distaste and part sympathy on Tom's face.
Christ, he's going to feel like death tomorrow.
Who was the girl, Tom? He knows what I mean. He doesn't try to dissemble. He simply shakes his head tiredly.
It doesn't matter.
It does, though. Was it Lara? We're speaking quietly. The darkness winds its way around us, enveloping us, comforting us. It's a blanket under which words can be uttered that would never be broached in the light of day.
What? No, it wasn't Lara.
I know he's looking at me. I can feel the weight of his gaze, though I can only discern his eyes from a slight gleam. I have the sense his head is cocked, but perhaps I'm projecting his mannerisms upon this dark canvas.
Why would you think that? That was just a holiday fling. It didn't mean anything to either of us.
Not Lara. Not only not Lara, but seemingly never Lara. I file that away for future analysis. So who was the girl? I ask again, doggedly intent. He doesn't speak for a moment. He's so still, I could believe he has fallen asleep standing. Eventually his words come, barely more than a whisper. You know who it was. Yes, I do know. There's an inevitability about it, a permanence, even though I recognize that I didn't know it all. I swallow. Now I do, I whisper. I didn't before. Things I've been scared to acknowledge I've wanted and hoped for, a gathering together inside me, a pressure that's building, straining, until I'm afraid to move lest I burst open. His hand reaches out, and I feel the back of his fingers trail gently down my cheek. I find I'm holding my breath.
I'm sorry I was such an unforgivable shit. It's just, there was a moment there, the other night, when I thought I was getting everything I'd always wanted. And then, reality set in.
His fingers drop. He turns his head away, and suddenly my stomach clenches into a hard knot. I know beyond a shadow of doubt that I will have to close myself off again, stamp down on all those things so eager to burst out.
And I was so fucked off, and myself mostly, for allowing it, for putting myself in that position. Because I knew better, really. You can say whatever you choose to say, pretend whatever you think you should feel. But I see it in you, tonight like every other night. It's always been Seb for you, hasn't it? You never even saw me. And I'll always know that.
He has it all wrong. Just like I've had it all wrong about so many things.
No. No, I protest urgently, my voice rising. That's not fair. That's not right.
But he barely notices my interruption. He's still talking in a low, oddly persuasive rumble.
When Modan is done, I'm going to move back to Boston.
A sudden crash comes from the bathroom. It sounds as if Seb has pulled something over, quite possibly the radiator, judging from the metallic reverberation. Tom is already moving in that direction.
Shit. Sorry, Kate, you'd better go.
He throws over his shoulder. Then he's pulling the bathroom door open. I catch a glimpse of his face in the yellow light that leaps out to paint him, harsh lines etched round his mouth.
Shit,
he says again. Then he disappears inside, and the door shuts abruptly. I'm left alone in the passageway. For a moment I stand there, completely at a loss. Surely I can help with whatever disaster is now unfolding. But then I realize, that's not the point. He doesn't want me here, and this is a convenient way to politely get rid of me. I consider that for a moment more, then take a shuddering breath, pick up my bag, and quietly leave the flat. In the taxi on the way home, I replay the night of Linacre Ball, when I first met Seb, and when, of course, I also first met Tom. I think about Tom dragging Seb along to the party, with quiet plans of speaking to a girl. Me, as it turns out. I wonder where he had come across me before. I don't suppose I'll ever find out. I wonder how different things would have been if I'd turned back for the man-boy with the marvellously hooked nose after jumping off the wall. But I have to stop that train of thought before I come apart a piece at a time. Then from nowhere, Tom's words from an afternoon not so very long ago in his flat float back to me. Seb likes to win. And I put that together with Seb's sly look.
Yes, who was that girl? I don't think you ever told me.
And I'm flooded with such savage fury that I want to scream with it. I know I'm an unholy mess. I wish beyond all reason that my dad was still alive. But he's not here, and I am, in a taxi driving through the deserted streets of London. So I go home to an empty flat, truly empty, as Severine is nowhere to be seen, and crawl into bed with all my clothes on, craving the oblivion of sleep. When I was growing up, my mother often used to say that things look better after a good night's sleep. I've always been my father's child, and he was never so blindly optimistic. In the morning, I'm still under suspicion of murder, and my love life still has not improved. And I remember that I still haven't found out what Tom saw all those years ago at the farmhouse. The office provides little respite. A potential client, big job, looking to flesh out their whole litigation team, but we're in stiff competition with two other recruitment firms, asks me diffidently about any
events in the private lives of the key personnel of Channing Associates that could be potentially reputation-damaging, were they to enter into a contract with us. I know immediately that the rumours aren't confined to Mark Jeffers.
Ah, I say, with what I hope is a knowing laugh. You're actually asking about the completely ridiculous rumour that I'm about to be sent down for murder.
Well, I can practically hear the squirming down the line. To tell you the truth, it's all horribly sad. A girl disappeared in the neighbouring farmhouse to where I was staying on holiday in France 10 years ago, and her body has just been found. Naturally, the police have spoken to all of us who were staying there, and naturally, we're all keen to do anything at all we can to help. I pause and add meaningfully, as I'm sure you would be, if you were in my shoes.
Yes, yes, of course. We just have to be very careful. As a firm, we pride ourselves on our unimpeachable reputation.
It's hard not to zone out. No matter what I have said, or can say now, we've lost this one. It was a tight race anyway, and rightly or wrongly, this just gives a reason for them to pick another horse. They won't say that, of course. I'm mildly curious to see what excuse they will come up with. My money is on them labelling us a comparatively new firm that has yet to be sufficiently proven. Paul comes in, his face grim, just as I'm putting down the phone.
I know, I say to forestall him, moving around my desk to rest my backside on it. I just had chapter and verse on reputation from Strickman's.
His mouth is in a thin line, almost as pale as his eyebrows.
What did you say?
The truth, as it happens. But we've lost it anyway.
They said that?
I shake my head.
No, but they will.
He pulls out his chair and flops into it, dispirited.
This isn't going away, Kate.
It will.
But even I can hear that I lack conviction.
Can't they arrest someone already?
I'd be fine with that, so long as it isn't me.
He almost bursts up out of his chair.
What the fuck, Kate? You said
joke, Paul. Just a joke.
You can't joke about this stuff, he says stiffly, but at least he subsides back into his seat. It's serious, Kate.
I know. We just lost Strickman's. Though we may never have got that one anyway.
So what are you going to do?
The you in his question rings out like a bell, loud and clear, reverberating in my brain. Paul is dissociating himself, preparing for the worst.
We're going to do our jobs, and we're going to do them very well.
I'm careful not to put stress on the plural pronoun.
Sure, he says. With no vigour.
He leans forward in his chair, elbows on his knees and hands hanging in between, staring at the floor.
Paul?
I speak sharply, pulling myself upright. He doesn't look up.
Paul!
This gets his attention.
Don't build this up to be something it's not. We're quite some distance from finished. I hired you because I knew you'd get out there and hustle. So get out there. Hustle! Otherwise, you're absolutely no good to me.
He stares back at me for a moment. I refuse to break eye contact. I have the advantage of height since I'm standing. It puts me in mind of wolf pack behaviour, fighting to be alpha male. Then I see a small gleam in his pale eyes.
Pep talk over?
He asks dryly. Or do you want to give me another kick up the arse? My lips twitch.
That's it for now.
Then a thought crosses my mind.
Oh, pass me the Mark Jeffers file, would you?
I haven't loaded it onto the network yet.
Why, do you have something suitable?
We'll see, I say, evasively.
I should have it up there by the end of today, unless you're in a hurry.
No rush, I tell him breezily, and circle my desk to sit back at my station. But Severine has planted herself in my chair. I should sit down anyway. I know I should, but I find myself saying to Paul, I'm running out for coffee. Want anything?
No, thanks.
He doesn't look up from his screen. I'm trying to cut back. Though that's kind of like holding back the tide in this job. It's true. We move from meeting to meeting, mirroring our candidates and clients. If they want to drink, we drink. If they want to eat, we eat. We are a service industry, and the service we provide is confidence. Through the medium of hot beverages and sustenance, every meeting has to whisper, "We're like you. We understand your problems, your needs. We feel your pain, and we can solve it." But how can the clients be confident I can solve their problems when they think I can't solve my own? My phone rings before I've crossed the road. Lara.
"Hi, hon. Can you meet for a coffee? Right now."
There's a note of blind panic threaded through her blunt question. It dredges up the unease always waiting inside me, curled quietly in the depths of my stomach. Lara is not melodramatic, or given to wild fits of runaway imagination. Those things take too much energy, and Lara would freely admit she's a little too lazy for that.
"What's up?"
"I just had a late lunch with Alan. I'll tell you in person. Can you meet?" I glance at my watch running through the afternoon's schedule in my head.
"Yes, I'll jump in a cab toward you. Usual place in 10 minutes.
"Yes." In the uncharacteristic terseness of her reply, I can hear her native accent begging for release. I start looking for a cab immediately. Once ensconced in a black taxi, the unease becomes corporeal, taking on the body of twisting snakes that are no longer confined to my stomach. Now they're swaying upward, encircling my lungs, slithering through my throat, threatening to choke me of words and breath. The thunk of the automatic door locks when the cab speeds up makes me jump, heart racing, adrenaline prickling through my skin. Severine appears beside me in the cab, scrutinizing me expressionlessly in her take-it-or-leave-it manner, but I deem her presence a gesture of solidarity. Whether it's intended that way, I'll never know, but I may as well take whatever comfort I can get from this creation of my own mind. The driver is unwilling to cross the traffic flow, so I leap out of the taxi on the other side of the road to the cafe and spot Lara immediately, already sitting at a table by the window with two tall mugs in front of her. Even through the logo-emblazoned window, I can see her face is pinched, but she manages an approximation of a smile and a sketch of a wave when she sees me crossing the road. She gets up to hug me as I enter, and I feel the tension clinging to her frame.
"What's up?"
I ask, as soon as we're both seated. She's wearing a dress I haven't seen before, a fitted sheath with a pattern like a snowstorm in the dark. I wonder if the lunch was planned, if she wore the dress especially for Mordan. She looks stunning as ever, but older somehow. Not in her face, which is exactly the same, but in less tangible ways. Her carriage, her demeanour, her very self.
"I had lunch with Alan. He wanted to apologize. He was hurt, lashing out. He still wants...
well, you know." I do, or I can imagine. I can extrapolate from what I know so far. And if I know anything about Alan Mordan, it's that he won't give up on Lara.
"But I keep telling him, not until this... the investigation is all done. I told him that again today, and he said that I shouldn't have to wait too long. Things were coming to an end. Only he looked very grim about it. I asked if he meant he was dropping the case, and he shook his head and asked if you have a lawyer yet."
"What?" The cafe fades away instantly. All I have in my focus is the beautiful, desperately worried face of Lara. She nods, a fast bob.
"Yes. He asked if you have a lawyer. I said I didn't know. I didn't want to give anything away. And he said you really ought to get one."
Jesus. I am staring at her in abject disbelief. This can't be happening.
"But, wait, there's more. He had a file on the table. One of those yellow cardboard things. It had her name on it. And yours. I could see it. He tapped it and then said he was off to the bathroom, just leaving it there with me. She spreads her hands wide. It was like he was inviting me to look at it.
Did you? Please say you did.
She nods again. Yes, even faster, guilt written on her face.
I know I shouldn't have, but I couldn't shake the feeling that he meant me to. I just had a quick look.
I'm nodding, wordlessly urging her on.
There was a report on the top. I didn't have time to read it all. I could only skim. But basically... Oh, Kate, basically the whole thing was about how he thinks you killed her.
The words are tumbling out of her. She can't keep up with them, and her accent is slipping.
Motive, opportunity, the whole nine yards. He reckons Seb passed out in the barn with Severine. You found him there and were enraged. You hit her with something. There was something about an old garden rake still having her blood on it. I didn't know that, did you? Apparently nobody ever washes garden rakes. Anyway, they're testing it for other DNA and fingerprints. So you hit her with the rake, then dumped her body. You knew the well was being filled in.
She stops abruptly, and we stare at each other. I can barely think. I can barely breathe. A garden rake? Slowly the rest of the cafe returns, the hum of conversation, the sound of the coffee machine, the disturbance of the air when the door is opened. A garden rake with blood still on it after 10 years. I feel clammy and ill. The hand that reaches out to pick up my mug of coffee is trembling, but my brain is starting to function again.
And you think he wanted you to look? Yes, he tapped the file.
She spreads her hands wide again, her eyes pleading for absolution.
He tapped it.
Don't feel bad. He meant you to look, I say decisively. We're talking about Mordan. He doesn't just accidentally. I sketch quotation marks around the adverb. Leave a sensitive file in plain view of someone with a vested interest in it. Which begs the question as to why he chose to do just that. Focusing on the strategy is making me feel better. Don't think about being arrested. Don't think about being arrested.
He's using me,
she says with sudden fierceness. She's almost vibrating with the intensity of her emotions.
He shouldn't be doing that. He shouldn't be putting me in this position.
I know. I don't think he would if he had another option. But so much hinges on whether that is really true. If he really cares about Lara, he would only use her as part of a last-ditch attempt to try and help her friend. Ergo, I'm in real, undeniable trouble. But if Lara is merely a passing fling, then he might well use her if his investigation is stalling, to try and flush out more information. Here I am questioning that which only moments ago was an incontrovertible truth. Wasn't I only just thinking that he would never give up on Lara? He loves her. He loves her not. He loves her. He loves her not. I find myself examining the woman sitting opposite me again, as if I can read the truth of Mordan's feelings for her in the tilt of her nose, the curve of her lips, the sweep of her cheek. A garden rake. How does one accidentally kill someone with a garden rake? Don't think about being arrested.
Either way, he thinks I know more than I'm telling, I say aloud.
What if it wasn't an accident? I see a long wooden handle whistling through the air, landing squarely on Severine's temple. A garden rake.
Either way?
Lara wrinkles her nose, puzzled.
Nothing,
I say quickly. Clearly Lara hasn't considered the possibility that she is being used for ill rather than good. She at least is convinced of his affections. Does that signify? I wonder what Tom will make of it all. There's no question in my mind that I will tell him. Tom may not want a relationship with me, but presumably I can trust a man who was once in love with me to be on my side. Will Tom trust in Mordan's feelings for Lara? It suddenly strikes me that I've been wrong before where Lara is concerned. Wrong for years, in fact.
Lara, when? Something slams into the window, right beside us with a loud thud. We both jump, knocking the table, our coffees slop everywhere. I feel the instant prickle of adrenaline sweeping over me again. Jesus, what was that?
gasps Lara, her face utterly drained of colour. The window is intact. I'm standing up, craning my neck with my head pressed against the window to look through it, past the coffee shop slogan stuck on the glass to the pavement below. A bird, I say. A pigeon. The dirty grey-feathered body is lying in a heap on the paving. It stunned itself. Jesus, says Lara again. I straighten and glance around the coffee shop. The barista continues to serve. Conversations are continuing among the paired clientele. Mobile phones continue to be inspected by those sitting alone. Nobody else seems to have noticed. I look out of the window. Passers-by hurry on, unheeding. Severine is among them, in her black shift, blood trickling from her right temple. It doesn't seem to be affecting either her balance or her self-possession. That was weird. I grab some napkins and start to mop up our spilled coffee. There must have been a reflection in the window. It must have thought it was flying into sky. That used to happen at school, in Sweden sometimes. I settle down again and return to my almost cold coffee. Lara, why did you and Tom never give things a proper go? She looks up from her coffee, startled. After France, you mean? Yes. I'm suddenly very self-conscious. Should I be holding eye contact or not? What impression am I giving about how vested I am in this answer? I always thought he wanted to, but you didn't. Oh. She's blushing a little. It underlines how pale she's been this afternoon. Actually, it was more the other way round. To be honest, I would have been up for it. At the time, I mean, not now. But he was definitely not into anything more. Oh. I consider that. Why did I think it was the other way around? I don't know. But she really is too honest to leave it like that. Except maybe... perhaps I gave you that impression. I felt a bit... well, rejected, I suppose. You weren't really around at the time. Right after France, you and Seb were splitting up and your dad died, and then you were up north for ages, and in quite a state even when you got back. I think you made the assumption, and I never really corrected it. Out of pride, I guess. I can see the guilty embarrassment squirming inside her. I can see the Lara of years ago, hardly unable to comprehend the concept of a man who doesn't want to climb back in the sack with her. It hasn't messed things up for you and Tom, has it? She asks, suddenly anxious. I don't think there is a me and Tom. Just like there never was a Lara and Tom. I got that wrong, for all those years, along with just about everything else. Am I wrong about how Mordan feels about Lara? Am I being played? Would you mind if there was? No, she says it hesitantly, like she's testing her answer. It feels a bit strange, but... she shrugs with a hint of a rueful smile. I'd have no right to mind, even if I did. An interesting response, an honest one, I think. I sigh. Well, it's a moot point anyway, since I'm apparently going to jail. A French jail to boot. I wonder, in an abstract way, if that is any better or worse than a British jail. And then it strikes me that it's no longer an abstract consideration. It's not funny, Kate, Lara says tersely. I'm not laughing. I feel clammy and ill again. I am definitely not laughing. We're many... many steps away from jail, I remind myself. Don't think about being arrested. I lean toward the glass and peer out of the window again, down toward the pavement. The grey feathered heap has gone. You have to speak to Alan. You have to give him something. Cooperate. You have to tell him. What? What can I tell him? I don't know anything to tell him. Yes, you do. You can tell him about Caro. You can tell him about the drugs. My eyes leap to Lara's, and she gazes back at me, clear-eyed and unflinching. I look across the divide between us,
the corridor of air. And it's like staring down a tunnel through the years, back to where it all began. Back to France and Severine. How far we've come. To get to this point. The point where you throw friends under buses. Except Caro is not really a friend exactly. But I'm splitting hairs. I start to form, then discard any number of responses. What are you going to do? Presses Lara. A garden rake. I'm going to call my lawyer. Chapter 17. I leave the cafe, already dialing my lawyer, but she's busy and unable to take my call. Of course she's busy. She's a professional at the top of her game, high in demand, which is exactly the sort of lawyer one would want to have. Only I want her sitting in her office, staring at her telephone and twiddling her thumbs, doing nothing of note except eagerly awaiting my call. I have half a mind to jump in a taxi to her premises, but I resist the urge and instead choose to walk back to my office. The fresh air fails to do me good. My mind is racing, unable to break free from a spiral track that leads inexorably to a dark pit of all the things I'm not yet ready to face. Surely there must be a way out, a bargain to be made with a god I don't believe in. How can this be happening to me? Jesus, says Paul. He doesn't look up as I enter the office. Did they have to get the coffee beans from South America? It takes me a minute to process the words and divine his meaning. Then I glance at my watch. I've been gone over an hour and a half. But surely not. The taxi there, plus the time spent with Lara, plus the walk back, it doesn't quite seem to add up. But my internal clock and the reckoning of my watch cannot arrive at a mutually agreeable answer. I have the sensation that time is rushing past me, rushing through me, like I'm no more substantial than a ghost, and there's nothing I can do to stem the tide. I forgot I had a call with Gordon. It's hard enough to invent an excuse, let alone give it some expression. I took it at the coffee shop. Paul looks up from his computer screen at that. Not a problem there, is there? He asks anxiously. I thought Caroline Horridge was the liaison now. No problem. Gordon just likes to keep his finger in the pie. The words make sense, but they mean nothing to me. Perhaps in a while, Paul and the business, and all those small concerns that add up to mean life, will catch at me with little hooks and lines, pulling me back into phase with the world. But for now, I feel like nothing exists except the looming dread of a French jail. Shock, I realize. I must be in shock. Well, I've loaded the Jeffers file now, if you want to take a look. Thanks. Oh, I nearly forgot. Someone called for you when Julie was out at lunch, wanting to know when you'd be back, but wouldn't leave a message. A woman, posh sounding. Well, that certainly narrows it down. I've refound irony. I must be anchored back in the real world now. Except, I glance quickly around. Severine is not here. But no. I've got that wrong. Severine is not real. Severine is not normal. My head is pounding. I sit down quickly. Are you all right? I hear Paul ask distantly. Fine, I say quickly, though I don't think my lunch entirely agreed with me. I'm getting to be quite the liar. Tom would be proud. Except why would he? After this is over, Tom is washing his hands of me. But this may never be over. Not for me. Where the hell is my damn lawyer? I grab the mouse, determined to focus on something else, and the blank monitor springs to life. After some time. How long? 5 minutes? 25? My vision clears, and the pounding in my head recedes. Sometime after that, I realize it must look odd for me to be staring at a screen, and for lack of anything better to do, I look up the Jeffers file, which is exactly where it should be, and perfectly up to date. Paul is nothing if not thorough. I skim through, noting his current role, and the familiar process begins to soothe me. Strengths, weaknesses, where would he fit? Stockley's? Hafton Weil? But no,
not there because... I stop suddenly as a flush of adrenaline prickles over my skin. Definitely not.